digital assets were created in part to offer an alternative to traditional financial structures and regulations, and so haven't always had a harmonious relationship with legislation. However, legal frameworks can provide value by enhancing predictability, ensuring safety, and encouraging broader participation in trade. The speakers in this podcast, taken from a showcase session at the IBA annual conference, consider regulatory approaches and developments in the application of the law. Luis Urrutia is Deputy General Counsel of the International Monetary Fund.
What we can see now is that we're still in a stage where there's enough lack of regulation, not only on the private law perspective, but also on the public law perspective. And this is something that we've seen that's changing. And from my own personal perspective, what I can tell you is that we are having much more clarity as for the direction where authorities are heading to, as we are now confirming risks that all these digital assets might bring to the general economic policies, the management of those economic policies, and also to financial stability. And this is why we're also asking ourselves, how come authorities have not yet taken sufficient steps to regulate all these digital assets? And the fact is that, I can tell you from my own perspective, when I was general counsel of the Central Bank of Mexico, we saw that the purported benefits is something that we needed to, in a way, incentivize by not regulating, by not taking specific regulatory actions, which is what has been the stance by many other authorities all across the world. But now that these digital assets have been growing and becoming more popular and are already creating more stronger linkages with the financial system, so what we expect in the few years to come is to see more specific aspects of regulation related to digital assets being taken by authorities all across the world. And for that, we are relying also on international standard setters to guide authorities as to what sort of regulation they need to have, mostly on the conduct prudential side, but also on the payment systems and other aspects that are relevant to the risks that these digital assets are having. So far, the regulation that has been issued is trying to take on the largest risks that have been identified, which is basically money laundering and terrorist financing. Financial Action Task Force, that's the international organization that's looking at the money laundering and terrorist financing risks on the financial system. They've already taken specific measures and issued specific standards to address this. And something similar might be seen also from the market regulators and financial regulators for these same purposes. To the extent that the authorities are starting to take on this, there will also be a better definition from this. When would a digital asset be considered a security, a commodity? What else can it be? And that will depend on not on the features of the actual assets, but how they are used. And this is something that authorities are taking that specific position, depending on the utility of these assets, whether it's an investment instrument, a payment instrument, regardless of the way they are built on, authorities will actually tackle them as a security, as a payment instrument, etc. Because of the borderless nature of these instruments, one specific feature we would all like to see is a harmonization across different jurisdictions. What we will have now is specific principles that the global standard setters are trying to make authorities aware of, but it will depend on the authorities, their own sovereign decisions to actually implement these and have those specific definitions. My fear is that we will still be seeing a more fragmented regulatory approach across jurisdictions, but at least in the principles, we'll be seeing a better harmonization. And applying that in the specific cases is what's still going to be a challenge.
Lee Pascoe is an insolvency lawyer at Norton Rose Fulbright with a specialism in fintech and digital currency. She discusses issues around definitions of property, jurisdiction, and the potential for harmonizing laws.
Not all tokens or digital assets are created equally. So in one instance, Bitcoin, for example, may be property because it's fungible, but is an NFT property? I mean, it could be. It could be in one jurisdiction and not the other jurisdiction. So if you have a look, the United Kingdom has actually done the best work on this. They've unpacked the definition of property. New Zealand is probably running second. They actually have a really good case in the Cryptopia collapse. They've actually looked at the question of what is property, and they've looked at it in the context of whether or not it can constitute a trust. So if a jurisdiction doesn't recognise cryptocurrency as property, it can never recognise it as being the subject of a trust. Again, that is being dealt with on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis. Then probably the next issue that we face is what we call the cross-border nature of these businesses. These businesses are borderless. They don't know borders. They're like sand. There are creditors in different jurisdictions. There are cryptocurrencies in different jurisdictions. Your books and records are in different jurisdictions. We had an instance with New Zealand again where the books and records of the company were in America held to ransom. So what we had to do is utilise one law that actually does cross borders and actually is good for these types of digital asset collapses. And it does actually demonstrate that when you harmonise a law, it can actually work. That's not a specific digital currency, or sorry, digital asset law. That's the UNCITRAL model law on cross-border insolvency. Not a law unto itself, but a model law which actually can then be incorporated into the individual jurisdictions. And 63 of those jurisdictions have adopted it. It's not perfect, but it is a demonstration of how harmonisation of a law or some form of model law can actually be quite effective to deal with these issues of borderless businesses.
The United States Uniform Commercial Code, Article 12, introduced in 2022 and now enacted in an increasing number of states, seeks to bring clarity and certainty to transactions of digital assets, as Drew Hinks, a partner at Winston & Strawn, who advises on digital assets and regulation, explains. Unlike many attempts at regulation, this has been a successful development.
There was an organization called the ULC that in 2018 was asked to look at the question of digital assets in the context of secured transactions in the United States. We had started to see the lending against digital assets start to become a thing. And the question was whether the law as it existed at the time was sufficient in order to cover appropriately the lending activity that was occurring. Now, a little bit of insight as to what was happening at the time. We have this law called the UCC. It's created by two organizations that's peopled by lawyers, academics, and judges called the ULC and the ALI. And they put together model laws, and then they offer them out to jurisdictions. They say, hey, state, here's this thing that I did. I think it would be helpful. If you like it, you should pass it. And so in 2018, they started studying whether there should be any changes made to better encompass and to better welcome digital assets that are being used in these sorts of transactions. What can we do to make this easier? And there were some problems that had been observed. First, there were no take-free rules. That means that it was not clear as to when one party transacts a digital asset to another party as to whether they are taking it subject to any claims. The second question, what exactly are these things anyway? You need to know what they are and how they're classified under the UCC to understand which rules apply. An NFT doesn't do the same thing as a Bitcoin, a meme coin doesn't do the same thing, a stablecoin doesn't do the same thing, a token that's backed by a claim against a T-bill held by an offshore custodian, these are all different products. There was also no understanding of how to deal with the portability question. Digital assets are made to move, that's the point. They are designed to transact. And so there was 3 years of study and drafting, and it resulted in the 2022 amendments. The linchpin of this was the creation of a new asset category. This is not a definition of property. Property is a function of state law. But it is the creation of defaults and gap fillers that are intended to streamline transactions between third parties. What that means is shorter documents, easier, cheaper deals, more commerce, everybody's happy. So the 2022 amendments seize upon this idea that we're describing the way that people interact with technology. And so it goes from the traditional test that's used, which is one based upon possession, to one based upon control. So it created this new definition called a controllable electronic record. You can identify a controllable electronic record because it's susceptible to control. I won't go into all the details, but control means that you can transact it to someone else. You can prevent it from being transacted to someone else. You can substantially enjoy the benefit of it, and you can identify yourself as the control party by your name, station, or some other code. there was a decision made that there should be equal dignity given to, or in certain cases, super priority given to, perfection of a security interest by control. So that means we're not running to file in a state registry anymore. We're not doxing the holder of a digital asset in a government registry, which lots of people don't like. What we're doing is we are allowing existing trade practices to be enshrined. The solution has been popular, and it's been adopted. This is, to date, the exception for digital assets, not the rule.
John Frost, Head of Innovation and the Digital Economy Unit at the Bank for International Settlements, discusses the idea of the Finternet and the importance of the law.
Finternet, of course, comes from the financial internet, the idea of actually being able to connect systems, having a range of applications like e-banking, digital wallets, financial apps, and even some non-financial apps, being able to integrate in the same system, being able to access data with user control, different providers, and really being able to allow for a platform for innovation and competition. And I think, especially for this audience, it's important to point out that the very foundation of this, that what it rests on, are laws, regulations, rules, and governance norms that are, of course, key to making this happen. The technology part is the easy part, if you will. The legal and regulatory part is the difficult one. And I think that there's really a lot of work still to be done there to allow this vision to take flight.